The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What is tunneling?
Tunneling is an ability that Jake was born with, where he can hold a personal object in his hands and he can sense exactly where the owner of that object is, like a human GPS, and he can also see what they're seeing and hear what they're hearing.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Susan Adrian, who is the author of a young adult spy novel titled Tunnel Vision.
Jake tunnels at a party as part of a game. He's 18 years old, and that turns out to be a very bad idea. Tell us what happens next.
At the time, he's just being a teenager. He drinks a little too much. He's trying to impress the girl that he likes, and so he shows off at a party game. And unfortunately, what he doesn't know is there's a government agent there watching him, or someone who's working with a government agent and recording him, and therefore they have all the evidence they need that he can tunnel and kind of wind him into a trap.
And he's really trapped sort of by the people he loves. The Department of Defense comes in and says that they want to test him, and they don't give him any choice. Describe what's going on with his family.
Well, his father died 2 years ago, and he's really protective of his mother and his little sister. His little sister is 12, and they have a very close relationship. And the way that they reel him in is by talking about an outside threat to his family that will attack him and take him away and go through his mother and sister, possibly hurt them if he doesn't cooperate with the government. And if he does cooperate, they promise him protection. So really, to Jake, it's not a choice at all. He has to protect his family at that point.
And what do they want him to do?
Well, they want him to spy for them. It's a terrific ability to have if you want to be a spy. His dad always told him never to do it because the military would absolutely love that. It's really long-range spying, and interestingly enough, DARPA did have a project to try to get people to do exactly that from the 70s to the early 90s. It was called Stargate, and they had people trying to do long-range spying psychically. They claim it never worked, but we don't know, of course.
And what's DARPA?
DARPA is a real agency. It's called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they are the scientific investigative branch of the government, or one of them. If you ever want to see some really interesting projects, go look at their website. I looked at it again yesterday. They have projects going on that are really kind of out there. Right now, they're looking at doing neural implants to help people retrieve memories. They use technology to help snipers target better. They have some sort of armor that soldiers can wear that they supposedly can't even feel, that can go under other kinds of clothing. So it's kind of crazy stuff, but it's all actually being researched right now. So it was perfect that they would be the agency that would use Jake, because they would.
Wow, it's like the edge of science fiction.
It is. Get some great story ideas just looking at what they're working on.
So someone called Dr. Miller comes and visits Jake, actually appears in his bedroom, and lays out this mandate. You're going to come with us and you're going to be tested and do what we want you to do, or else we'll let these bad guys hurt you and your family. That's the initial threat. But explain how they force him to expose the extent of his abilities. I mean, they take him to this facility. He wants to trick them, but it turns out that he can't.
And throughout the book, honestly, he keeps getting himself in trouble because he's an 18-year-old boy and he always thinks that he can get out of situations, and sometimes he just can't. When they bring him into this facility, it's a DARPA facility. He has to give up his phone and his watch before he can go through there. And that is actually, I really researched what you would have to do if you were visiting their offices. And that part's true. And then so he ends up in a room where he's being recorded. He thinks that he can fake it, but they hook him up to a polygraph machine to see if he's telling the truth or not. And when he tries to lie, it shows right up. So
right away at the beginning of the story, he is boxed in, completely boxed in, which ratchets up the tension a lot. Well, I'd like you to read a passage in which Jake tunnels, just so we can see what that's like. So he's in the Department of Defense facility, or DARPA, right, undergoing tests. He's resisting, and Dr. Liesl Miller is telling him how this project will go.
Okay. "I want this project to succeed. I want your skills to be an asset to this country, but I need your full cooperation, and I mean full, here and in what we will ask of you in the future. If you grant us your full, willing cooperation with all that we ask, you can return to your life at the end of the day." She smiles, white teeth through red lips. "There is more, of course, further details, but we'll discuss those after the tests, the successful tests. Do you understand? It's a hell of a deal. You're here, and we'll lock you up forever right now, and no one will have any idea what happened to you. Or do well in our tests, and maybe we'll let you out. What can I do? I can't choose door number one, the instant padded cell." "Yes." "Yes, you'll cooperate?" I nod, silent. I didn't want to say it again. "Excellent. I'll go back to the observation room, and we'll try this again." She pats my arm this time. "I'm certain we will have better results." The doctors come back and get all set up in their positions without a single comment. I still have the ring clutched in my hand. When Dr. Milkovich gives me the signal, I hunch over it, close my eyes, and let it come, the glow, the buzzing. I speak what I see. A man, middle-aged, medium height, beer belly, black rim glasses, dark wispy hair combed flat, tan slacks and a doctor's coat. Location, Arlington, Virginia, 3701 North Fairfax Drive, 12th floor, Lab 1235. He sees a bunch of squiggly pink things outlined in a circle of light. A microscope. Without looking up, he says, "The SDCC-1B is definitely showing signs of preferential hydrolysis." I set the ring on the bag. "This guy's two floors down." "It's a test," Dr. Milkovich says, even. But she has the look Mrs. Timmerman had at the party, times 10, like her fantasies have come true. Dr. Lennon peers at his screen like it has the mysteries of the universe on it. Wonderful. I bag up the ring and pass it back to her and answer some questions for the machine. She slides me another bag. This one has a small slip of paper folded in quarters, so worn it's yellow and falling apart at the creases. I pluck it out carefully, with two fingers, and hold it in my hands. Another man. He's old, tufts of gray hair like steam escaping from his ears. A gray, grizzled beard. Location, Toulouse, France. Place de Capitole. A small cafe on the edge of the plaza. He has a false leg. I can feel the joint aching at the knee. He rubs it absentmindedly. He sits in the sun at a table with a bright red umbrella, a cup of coffee in front of him, white china and a plain white saucer. He lifts his chin to survey the plaza, the noise of the crowd floating past. He raises the coffee, sips. He feels calm, content. I let the paper fall, open my eyes. Odd to do two in a row like that. The only other time I'd done that was at the party. I feel a little disoriented, jerked from one reality to another. Dr. Milkovich scribbles like crazy. "Was that real time? You were seeing what he's seeing right now, in France?" Dr. Lennon asks, his voice tinged with awe. "Yes." "Did you really feel what he was feeling, physically and emotionally?" "Yes." More questions on how it felt, what I did, how I did it. The questions take longer than the tunnel. I wish there was a way to stop this. Dr. Milkovich jumps up. "Excuse me for a minute." She thrusts her card in the door and runs out. "She moves like a squirrel," I say. Dr. Lennon chuckles. "It's true," but doesn't respond. He's busy typing. Dr. Milkovich is probably talking to Liesl and who knows who else, discussing me, how they're going to use me. I wonder if I could kill a man just by telling the wrong person, by telling them where he is. The answer's obvious. Yes.
This is a story in which a good person feels like he's forced to lie to people he loves because he doesn't see any other way to protect them. Was that a dilemma that you chose on purpose and mapped out?
I wouldn't say I mapped it out. I tend to be a person who just writes the story as it comes to me and it follows along pretty naturally. But definitely that was one of the things I had to think about a lot, because Jake would never lie to his little sister. It's just something he wouldn't do. And he finds himself having to do it over and over. And it kills him. It's harder than a lot of the other things that he's doing. I actually discovered as I wrote the book that the relationship between them was really significant to me and to him. It was really important for me to carry that all the way through. Working on the sequel right now, it's even more important there.
Hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because the end of the book leaves it open for a sequel.
It does.
Do you have a young adult reader in your life who gives you feedback on the story?
I do have a 13-year-old daughter.
Uh-huh. So you know that the kid will be texting and not talking on the phone to the friend.
Absolutely. And I do have to say that a lot of his little sister is not based absolutely on my daughter, but things that I observe, things about her character, perhaps. She disagrees. She's read the book. She doesn't think it's like her at all. But there's a lot of things in there that I see that remind me of her.
This is a young adult novel that's been published by St. Martin's Press. What's the backstory to getting a novel published by St. Martin's Press?
Well, backstory to this book was long. I have been actually trying to get published for 15 years now, and there came a point about 10 years in where it was so frustrating that I actually quit. Before I wrote this book, I had an agent for 3 years, hadn't sold anything, had been working on a book for 2 years solid, trying to revise it and so that she was happy with it, and it just never worked out. And I had this big revelation, I thought, where I don't have to do this anymore. No one's making me do it, so I could just quit. So I tried that, and I told my agent that I was done, and I put everything aside, and I thought, well, what do non-writers do? I guess they read a lot of other books, and they watch TV. So I actually went on this TV-watching binge, and one of the shows that I watched was called Chuck, which is a TV show about a normal guy who gets information from the government downloaded into his head and he becomes a spy. And I just loved the show. And I started to get to the point where I felt a little lost without a story in my head. So at night, I started telling myself a story from night to night. And it was kind of loosely based on Chuck, but it was a boy instead. And he had these powers from the beginning. And what would happen if it actually went further than the show let it go? And so I never wrote it down because I decided that I quit. But from night to night, I would tell it to myself. And about 2 months of doing that, I looked at the clock once and it was 3 a.m. and I was still awake because it was so twisty and turny and fabulous that I loved it. And if it was keeping me awake, I figured maybe I better write it down. And so that's Tunnel Vision, was that story. And then I got a new agent, and we were out on submission for a long time, but we finally found an editor, a male editor, who really connected. He sold it to his publisher, and there we are. It finally broke through. I think the reason that it broke through is because I actually wrote it without any outside pressure, because it was just a story for me that I loved, that I created for myself. And I think maybe that's part of why it finally broke through.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Susan Adrian, author of the YA spy novel Tunnel Vision. If you've just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. The audio is posted on our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll find out more about Jake's family and hear another passage from the book. Don't go away. Thank you.
If you could go back to the beginning of those 15 years and do something different, would you?
Strangely enough, I don't think that I would. I think that myself of 15 years ago would probably come and kick me for that because there was a lot of struggle and a lot of heartbreak trying to get something published, a lot of rejection. But I have to say that all of it, having an agent that didn't work out and writing all the books that I wrote that are in a drawer, this was actually my fifth book. I think that they were all necessary to get me to the point of where I am now. And there is no way that I would have written this book the way that it is without all that experience. So I think that in the end, it was important to go through everything that I went through. Maybe that's just true in life, right? If you did a time machine, you would mess up something and find out that it screwed everything else up. But I love this story so much. I'm so passionate about this character, or all the characters, really. And being able to tell this story. And oh, another thing I wanted to talk about is the fact that I'm so excited it's in libraries. That's my favorite part of this whole process. It's in bookstores and I get to meet people for that, but my therapy is looking at WorldCat and seeing how many libraries it's in and seeing that it's checked out. And that just makes me so excited to imagine actual kids checking it out and reading it, or people, adults checking it out and reading my book. That's fantastic.
Well, I think one of the most fascinating parts of your story is that you had to give up in order to find your way into this book.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just keep pushing forward in a direction that's not working.
Well, and you know, that's one of the major pieces of advice. Don't ever give up. I still say it, except for now I say, don't ever give up, or if you do, come back.
If you do, watch a few episodes of Chuck.
Something will inspire you. It did cement for me that I have to be a writer. It's in me, and there's no way that I can stop telling stories, even if it's just for myself. I apparently need to do it.
Apparently, you wrote 4 books before this one.
Right.
4 whole books.
Whole books.
Yes.
Several times. Yes. I actually was really pleased at one of the passages that we read, because I stole one line from the very first book that I wrote, and I got to read it today. So that was pretty cool.
Which one?
He has hair like steam escaping from his ears. That was in the first book that I wrote 15 years ago in the first chapter. And I just decided I was going to put it in somewhere.
Well, the publicity for Tunnel Vision promised a heart-pounding, action-packed novel, and they did not lie. I was halfway through the book at 10:30 one night, and I didn't go to sleep until I finished it.
Yay!
Even though I had to get up early the next morning. But there was so much tension. How did you create that kind of tension?
I really worked on keeping the suspense that there was always something that you were wondering about and worried about. It helps that there's a lot of action stuff going on, and there's, you know, car chases and guns, and I like that kind of thing. I love Jason Bourne movies, and so I would put that kind of thing in it. But I also, honestly, I would think of what would happen in a Jason Bourne movie, and then I would do something slightly different, because I wanted to do something you wouldn't expect. So always it tried to be something that the reader wouldn't expect and something that would keep that suspense going, the questions.
I think that's what I liked about it, because I read a lot of books, and yeah. So it's hard to trick me. Your bio says you spend time researching spy stuff and learning Russian. Do you remember how you became interested in all that?
I have to say that's a little bit of an untruth right now, because I had to stop learning the Russian when everything got kind of crazy with the book and I started doing the book tour. So I put it aside, and the way that my brain is, I've completely forgotten everything. But I pick up languages really easily and I drop them just as fast. But I will go back to that. Honestly, I had the idea for this book, and then I started to do all of this research. I signed up for like the CIA newsletter that you can sign up for, and I started looking at their website and looking up research in scientific journals. I am a scientific editor, and I used to edit scientific journals, so I knew there were journals for this sort of thing. So I would read all sorts of interesting things about the types of surveillance that you can do and what kind of devices you have to have for that kind of surveillance. And it just got more fascinating the more I did it. So I think that that's always a good sign that you're onto something that interests you. And obviously I wasn't doing that when I was writing it in my head, but when I actually had to write it down, there were all sorts of details I needed to know, and they were fascinating.
Well, I want you to read another passage from the book, but before that, what else do you want us to know about Jake and his family and his dilemma?
Possibly to know that it's not over, because I'm working on the sequel right now, and there's lots of exciting things still in store with almost all of the characters that are in this book carry over, which is great fun. And also, we haven't talked about his grandfather. One of the other important things in the book to me was Jake's grandfather, who is Dedushka. He's Russian, and he plays a very important part in how Jake came to be who he is and why he is like that. And they have also a very close, interesting relationship, and I've gotten a lot of comments from readers that they really identify with that relationship and with that character. So that was a really fun character to write as well.
So let's end with another passage. It's on page 68.
Yeah.
Before you read it, tell us who Anna is.
Oh, Anna is his handler. He has two handlers throughout the course of the book, Anna and Eric. And she's actually placed by DARPA in his house. They trick his mother into hiring a housekeeper. And so she's a housekeeper. And so he feels very intruded upon having someone actually spying on him in his house. But she's a pretty good person, so he has a pretty good relationship with her. Okay. I don't remember the first time I tunneled. When I was little, it used to happen all the time, accidentally. Random images, sounds, emotions would flick through me when I touched things. I thought it was normal. I learned quickly which things not to touch, what I didn't want to feel. Things from dead people, mostly. I do remember the first time I did it on purpose. I was 6 and a half, and Mike was a baby, about 4 months old. I thought she was a tiny monster. She was always fussy, bawling her lungs out day and night, sucking up every second of my parents' time and attention. I wanted nothing more than to send her back. We were alone for a few minutes, which was rare. I don't remember where we were living. Military housing somewhere. Dad was out mowing the lawn. I remember hearing the comforting buzz of the mower, smelling the fresh grass through the open windows. And Mom was in the kitchen. Micah was sleeping in her car seat on the floor while I played with plastic dinosaurs. I must have roared a little too loud because she woke up and started screaming. "Jakey," Mom called, frazzled. "Can you just watch her for a couple of minutes? I can't come right this second." "Okay," I called back, and Micah screamed harder. I stared at her, her little face scrunching, washing completely purple in seconds. Why was she doing that? What was worth getting that upset about? I guess a normal kid would have picked up her binky and put it in her mouth to make her stop. I picked up her binky, cradled it, and closed my eyes. I could see her, just as she was. That wasn't a surprise. I could hear the same things I could before, but everything seemed magnified, distorted. The mower was obscenely loud, terrifying. Mom's clanks in the kitchen, the water running, added to it, so the noise was almost unbearable. The breeze through the window was cold, a shock on her skin. She opened her eyes, and I saw myself, sitting cross-legged in front of her, eyes closed. I looked huge. The room was all huge, too bright, too many colors and shapes, all unknown, without meaning, all scary. "Shh," I thought. "It's okay, little one. Nothing's going to get you." Her eyes moved back to me. "That's me. I'm Jake," I thought. "Your big brother. I'll protect you." She stopped crying like a tap turned off. Watched me, flailing her fists in the air. "I'll teach you about all these things. Don't worry. I'll keep you safe. I promise." I opened my eyes, and I swear she smiled at me. She wasn't overly fussy after that if I was around. If she started that awful crying, I'd find a quiet place somewhere, hold her binky or her blanket or whatever, and tunnel to her. With her, I could actually communicate. In feelings then, if not words. Not just see. She also knew I was there in her mind, which nobody else ever seemed to. I figured it was because we were blood, or maybe she had a tiny bit of what I had. We didn't talk about it. But tunneling calmed her, always. Even as we got older, I did it every once in a while, when I wanted to check on her, or when I knew she was having a rough day. Like now. I close the calc book, assignment done, and pull a folded note out of my wallet. "I love you, Jake," it says, with a heart, in shaky red crayon letters. She'd given it to me when she was 6. I hold it in my hand, let my head drop forward. She isn't studying for once. She's lying on her back on top of her blue comforter, hair fanned out around her, staring at the white popcorn ceiling. Her old stuffed animal, horse, is next to her on the pillow, its worn-down brown fur soft against her cheek. She's worrying, but not about Anna, about me. "I'm fine," I think. "You don't have to worry. It's all going to be okay." I see the ceiling, feel a horse against her cheek, feel her awareness of me. She relaxes a little. "No more worrying," I think. "Just do what you usually..." I'm not sure I like the idea of you doing that on your own. I turn, the note clenched in my hand. Anna stands in the doorway, arms crossed. Despite the warning in the words, her expression is friendly. I don't feel friendly. I feel invaded. The door was shut. Doesn't that mean it's my private space? Her lips pinch. "I do not think you understand this situation yet, Mr. Lucan. You no longer have private space. Not from us. Not if we're to protect you." I meet her eyes straight on. "It's been 3 days since I made this deal, since any of this happened. Maybe you guys could give me a little time to adjust to the complete loss of my privacy?" She smooths her hair, considering. "Yes, that is true. I will keep that in mind." She drops her arm, the bracelet jingling. "I came to call you to dinner, but I think we should establish a rule of no private tunneling until we can discuss the implications. Yes?" I lift my chin but don't reply. "I'm not agreeing to that. Tunneling is mine, like always. I'm just letting them use it." She nods as though I agreed. "Dinner in 5 minutes, please. I will go and fetch your sister." I carefully replace the folded note in my wallet, check Dad's watch. 5 minutes will give me plenty of time to bang my head on the desk a few times before going to face dinner.
Susan Adrian lives in Butte, Montana. Look for more information about her and Tunnel Vision at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, book reviews, poems, and book excerpts, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.